Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, C.A. Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, C.A. George Washington is popularly known as the father of his country, fitting recognition for one whose example as revolutionary hero and first president set a high standard for all succeeding generations of Americans. We can, I think, with equal fidelity, regard Thomas Jefferson as the author of our nation. Now more than two centuries into the grand American adventure, it is still the grace, eloquence, and reason of his thought that animates the American ideal. Centered in the Enlightenment, framed by classical tenets of religion and philosophy, and crafted with the artful grace of an original mind, Thomas Jefferson gave his country an immortal library of wisdom. As we know, the chief quality of wisdom is timelessness. The words of Jefferson are more than appropriate for today, and they are essential for tomorrow. This becomes clear in a new collection of his writing, Light and Liberty, Reflections on the Pursuit of Happiness, whose editor is Eric S. Peterson. Eric Peterson, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you, George. Nice of you to have me.
It's great to have you here. And let's begin with a question that I think struck me right off the bat as I read this really quite marvelous little book. The genesis of it. You're a lawyer, and I think you work very much in public interest law in particular. I think, if I recall correctly, you began to put this together, research in the early 90s?
Yes, I did. I've always had a great admiration of fondness for Thomas Jefferson, like so many Americans do. I didn't know that much about him, but I had the opportunity to tour his home at Monticello and was re-inspired to immerse myself in his thought. And I found that Thomas Jefferson, he expressed himself nobly. He wrote in poetic prose, expressing ennobling thought. And after having a chance to read through everything that he wrote, I decided to try to distill its essence, his thought, down to its very essence, and try to make it easily available for people today. I think we're all searching for wisdom and truth in the vision of our founders.
Easily available for people today, and that, of course, would lead to the book itself. The book, Eric, I take it, is aimed not just at the general reader, but beyond that, at the working politician as well. Who did you intend this for?
I wanted to make it available for everybody. You know, he wrote some 20,000 letters. He never wrote a book itself, save one. It was called Notes on the State of Virginia. It was a series of answers to questions that have been asked him by the French ambassador. So when you encounter his writings, it's 20 volumes of letters, really.
Yeah.
And you have to read through there to capture his philosophy, because a lot of it was correspondence with friends, with fellow colleagues, politicians at the time. They've done a nice job, for example, down at the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, in culling out a few inspirational passages in Lighten the People Generally, and Tyranny and Oppression of Body and Mind Will Vanish Like Evil Spirits at the Dawn of Day. Now, gems like that you find throughout Thomas Jefferson's writings, and I made it my hobby, my avocation, to sort of cull through all of his letters. He wrote on all sorts of topics, as we know, and try to bring it together in one useful form.
As you did, and I can testify that, having read it. The selections in this marvelous little volume are categorized by subjects like happiness, gratitude, patriotism, love, sincerity, and so forth. And I want to ask you this, Eric, about the quality of the mind behind them, because you, in fact, you did cull through 20,000 letters and other documents to put this together. And as I read them, no matter what the subject was, I began to see a consistency of mind, so to speak, a unity of thought that kind of runs through them. And I kind of wondered if you had the same feeling, and if so, how you might characterize that quality, no matter what the particular topic may be.
Well, I was looking for the heart of Thomas Jefferson's vision. And he believed in the ancient Greek wisdom, which, as he summed it up, says that happiness is the aim of life, virtue is the foundation of happiness, and utility is the test of virtue. So he's saying, in order for something to be virtuous, it has to actually work to produce happiness. And of course, we all know he was the author of the great phrase, pursuit of happiness.
Yeah.
And so he believed that we could find happiness by cultivating our own virtues and good qualities. Mm-hmm. So I used themes, as you mentioned, aspiration, truth-seeking, seeing the good in others, not thirsting for gain, dreaming the impossible, all these wonderful expressions of virtue that we would all want to aspire toward, as well as have our nation aspire toward.
Exactly.
And so I called out perhaps 1,000 of these kinds of expressions, and I grouped them under these qualities. And mm-hmm. I took the further step of actually trying to piece them together mm-hmm. into smooth-flowing essays as if they had been written in a single session.
When you look at this body of literature, these collected quotations and writings, you get the sense that Jefferson very much wanted the country to speak to the world with a particular sort of national voice, that we had a kind of purpose, actually, that it was up to every American to express, and as well as our government to carry out.
He called the United States Constitution the primitive and precious model of what is to change the condition of man all over the globe. Mm. And he said quite hopefully and optimistically, as it was his wont, that the ball of liberty is now so firmly in motion that it will roll around the world. He, like President Washington, who you mentioned, and the other greats, Franklin, of our founding era, knew that they had a once-in-a-millennium opportunity to try to demonstrate that self-government that protected the rights of man mm-hmm. was a practicable government, because it didn't exist anywhere else in the world at the
right.
time. And they knew they were setting an example. They called it the Great Experiment. Mm-hmm. And indeed, the Ball of Liberty has, to a large extent, rolled around the world. And I think we can give a lot of credit to Thomas Jefferson's vision and the sacrifices that he made in his life, as well as his fellow founders, that indeed is the case.
This book, you know, when I think about this book, and having read it myself, and I'm going to keep my copy close to me, because it seems to me that you can use this in several different ways, several different contexts. It clearly can speak to an individual about problems of everyday life, in a sense, but to a society as a whole, about a vision that the country can share. And so the reader, Eric, I think, is tempted to, and can't resist the temptation, to perhaps isolate those portions of it that have special meaning for him. So if you don't mind, I'm going to do that first myself and tell you why I found something that just, as the phrase goes today, blew me away. And then I'm going to turn to you very briefly and ask you to do the very same thing. I think that those listening will enjoy the exercise. I certainly hope they do. And let me go first, if you will. I'm going to pick and then tell you why I've done it. Something that occurs on page 11 here, and I can turn right to it. It's in the chapter on aspiration, and as you've said earlier, the book is geared around the virtues and the attitudes that people should focus on and bring to bear in their life. I'm going to go down a paragraph and just read this excerpt and then tell you why it struck me so powerfully. These are Jefferson's words, of course. We are therefore wisely framed to be as warmly interested for a fictitious as for a real personage. The field of imagination is thus laid open to our use, and lessons may be formed to illustrate and carry home to the heart every moral rule of life. Thus a lively and lasting sense of filial duty is more effectually impressed on the mind of a son or daughter by reading King Lear than by all the dry volumes of ethics and divinity that were ever written. This is my idea of a well-written romance of tragedy, comedy, and epic poetry. Well, I am a lifelong English major, and I have always felt that the quality of political life in this and perhaps any country is marvelously enhanced by the ability of people to go to the great works of literature and find in them the inspiration and the understanding of the human condition that all too often is very sadly lacking in politicians. That, an American politician, really, of more than two centuries ago, would cite that as something that politicians, leaders, thinking men and women should do, is stunning.
Jefferson was, in many ways, an artist. He was a farmer. He was a naturalist. He was a scientist. He loved great literature. He had one of the greatest libraries in America at the time, and he valued it very highly. And he encouraged all those around him to read. He self-studied 14 hours a day as a student, so he loved to immerse himself in great works of literature and as well as the political thinking that he did, his thinking as a naturalist in the world of agriculture. Mm-hmm. So, yes, he was a great, he was an artist, he was a musician, he mm-hmm. played the violin, mm-hmm. he encouraged his children to play musical instruments, and that was his primary mm-hmm. form of entertainment. It was music mm-hmm. as well as interest in the arts and literature.
But, you know, and I'm sure you've heard this phrase a million times, Eric, the Renaissance man. I mean, that's the phrase we use these days. And that's appropriate. Yet I'm so struck by, and I don't want to launch a sermon or tirade here, but by how specialized political life in our country, for example, has become, where men and women don't develop these other aspects of themselves, don't see in them that there is a path to, you know, really developing a humane philosophy of governance and other things as well. So, I mean, it's just stunning. He was, my God, he was a man for the ages just for that quality alone.
Yes, and he believed that everyone had been given certain qualities, mm-hmm. certain gifts, certain talents. He didn't believe everybody was equal in talent. Mm-hmm. They were equal in rights and in their divine essence. But everyone had different talents, and it was important in the democratization of society for a governmental structure and a societal acceptance of that governmental structure to allow people's individual gifts and qualities to come forth.
Right.
He believed a lot in self-improvement and mm-hmm. self-perfection. Mm-hmm. He said that our greatest happiness does not depend upon the condition of life in which chance has placed us, but is always the result of good conscience, good health, occupation, and freedom in all just pursuits.
We're going to touch on practically all of that in our conversation. I'm going to touch on health in particular in a moment. And as I said, I'm going to ask you to read something. Before I do that, though, I want to ask this other question. It just occurred to me because it struck me very powerfully among the many selections of this book. And before we turn to your reading, his views on religion, and particularly his sense of the figure of Jesus, historically and as kind of a humane and human leader. There's something called the Jefferson Bible, which is a composition that he derived, I think, from the direct quotations of Jesus and sort of eliminate much of the other material of the Bible. How would you describe Jefferson's sense of religion?
Well, what he did with the Jefferson Bible, as you indicated, kind of captured it. And it's not dissimilar to what was done in this book, Light and Liberty, as well, because he was a great private student of religion, of Christianity and other religions as well. He read through the Bible. He focused in on the exact words of Jesus only. Mm-hmm. He thought of Jesus as a great moral teacher, a great philosopher. And he felt that the churches over time had built up institutional structures which tended to promote the interest of the wealthy and the powerful, taking the average citizen away from their own personal faith. Thomas Jefferson once wrote that I am of a sect by myself, as far as I know. If I could not go to heaven but with a party, I would not go there at all. And he was constantly urging young people to think for themselves and to develop a useful personal productive life philosophy.
Right.
And at one point he wrote that the relations which exist between man and his maker and the duties resulting from those relations are the most interesting and important to every human being and most incumbent upon his study and investigation. So his religion was very personal, was very private. He was a great advocate, as we all know, of human reason, enlightened human reason. He said every man's reason should be his own oracle.
Right.
He believed in human conscience. He said conscience is the only sure clue which will guide us free and clear of all doubts and inconsistencies.
I think all of these qualities make him, I mean, I find this, to be quite honest with you, tremendously appealing. I think he used a phrase once about his sense of what we might call formal or orthodox religions as too often, in his opinion, making Christ, and I quote, the victim of the altar and the throne, that this conceptualization that didn't suit him characterized Christ in ways that he found very limiting.
He felt that he said at one point that Christ died a victim to the combined power of altar and throne. Mm-hmm. And that really takes us to the freedom of religion that Thomas Jefferson, I believe, felt most strongly about, of all the rights of man. The rights enshrined in our Bill of Rights, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, right to trial by jury, freedom from arbitrary governmental arrest and coercion and so forth and imprisonment. Freedom of religion was first on his list. Mm. When he ran for president in the year 1800, he was bitterly attacked particularly by the clergy in New England as a fanatic in politics and an atheist in religion. And certainly there was some, you could draw from some of his writings something along that line. It was totally incorrect. He was not a fanatic. He was not an atheist. But he was attacked for his advocacy of what he called famously the wall of separation
right.
between church and state, by which he meant a wall of separation between the power mm-hmm. of civil government and the power of organized religion mm-hmm. was important for the protection of both,
right.
particularly the protection of religion.
Right. You know, this just struck me, Eric, and it's implicit in every part of this book and in what you just said, to not just to harbor these thoughts, to express them, to let them guide his internal philosophy and his action in life against, and you cited the New England clergy in this example, against what must have been some pretty formidable opposition, speaks to a man of an indomitable personal spirit. I mean, how do you see him? I mean, he had to stand up against quite a bit, I would think, to offer these kinds of views, even in his own.
He was very courageous, but I feel that he had a profound, what we might call today, spiritual faith. Mm-hmm. It was not really directly connected with any particular organized religion. In fact, he said that one of his famous phrases was, it does me no injury if my neighbor believes there are right. 20 gods or no god. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg. Mm-hmm. So you would often see him use the phrase our religion in his public addresses in a very general sense, by which I believe he simply meant a love of God or love of the supreme being, the mm-hmm. supreme ruler of the universe he would refer to the creator as. So he did have a deep personal faith. And at one point earlier in his career, he wrote famously that the God who gave us life gave us liberty at the same time. Mm. The hand of force may destroy, but cannot disjoin them. So he really felt that our rights, our precious rights, the human rights of man, were given to us by nature,
right.
the hand of nature and nature's God. He even believed in the human soul. Mm-hmm. In the souls of nations. He once referred to the Declaration of American Independence as the genuine effusion of the soul of our country
right.
at that time.
That's very helpful, because just hearing that, I can see how that would sustain him against any attack and just really bring him through, not just for his own time again, but for our time as well. Eric, this is the part of our conversation that I've really, really... I look forward to the entire conversation, but I sort of have been, how should I put it, happily anticipating asking you this question. Everything in here, and I think people listening will sense just in the way you speak, is clearly something that you love and have found great meaning in. But if I were to ask you, Eric Peterson, for this moment in the conversation, if you would be so good as to go to the book, pick up something so we can hear your own voice, read this material, and tell us what it means to you.
Thank you for the opportunity, George. Light and liberty go together. I look to the diffusion of light and education as the resource most to be relied on for ameliorating the condition, promoting the virtue, and advancing the happiness of man. Enlighten the people generally, and tyranny and oppression of body and mind will vanish like evil spirits at the dawn of day. If a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. No nation is permitted to live in ignorance with impunity. This is the reason that I chose Light and Liberty as the title for this collection of Thomas Jefferson's inspirational wisdom. It's something that I learned about as I studied more of his thought and wisdom. because we have a tremendous faith in our country, in freedom, and in liberty. But you don't hear the other part of Jefferson's duality talked about that much, the light that goes together with liberty. Essentially, Thomas Jefferson is saying, no light, no liberty. And by light, of course, he meant freedom from ignorance. And what is ignorance? Ignorance is an excessive focus on what separates us and what divides us, on our differences, rather than on what we have in common, what unites us and makes us all one people. This is why I believe his philosophy was a philosophy of freedom and oneness, or light and liberty. Light meaning a sense of identification with your fellow man. Right. Every man does have an interest in the peace, prosperity, and happiness of every other. To Jefferson, the connection between light, freedom from ignorance, if you will, and liberty, freedom from coercion, was inseparable. It was almost an axiomatic law of nature. Light and liberty go together. And you have to have slow and steady progress. You have to have patience for the evolution, the education, and the awareness and the, of a civilization. He said light on a societal basis was a spirit of reason, candor, moderation, tolerance, respect, and he said mild laws readily obeyed, and valuing self-government above all other blessings. So if you try to give liberty to another country, for example, as we are attempting to do in the Middle East, to Jefferson it would be axiomatic that since light and liberty go together, you can only progress so far on the liberty front as the enlightenment of the particular society and culture will actually permit.
Right.
So you can see how that principle might play itself out in the concept of international relations.
Indeed, and I am actually very glad I asked you that question. That was a marvelous answer, if I say so myself. And you speak of the international implications of that sentiment. There are also very strong domestic implications, and it seems to me that the creation of liberty depends upon light, but the preservation of liberty for us in this country would also depend upon light being here combating ignorance, which brings up a very interesting point about this book, Eric. As I understand it, you're not getting any royalties from this book. Is that right?
No, there's no royalties associated with this project.
And what do you want to have happen with this book? Or who is it? Who do you want to be reading it? What is its purpose? You're not getting royalties. You want it to go out to...
Well, to me, it's a service project. I do this outside my normal work life as an attorney, a project attorney for state and local governments. Mm-hmm. And I've really enjoyed the inspiration that Thomas Jefferson has afforded me. When I went down to Monticello in my teenage years, I was generally inspired by the beautiful architecture there, nature and its beauty and so forth. And I really wish that someone had given me this book when I emerged from my tour of his beautiful home at Monticello, because he really does have the capacity to uplift.
Right.
When you read Thomas Jefferson's wise words, your own spirits just automatically rise. There's something, there's some enlightening or uplifting, or joy-giving quality to his thought. And so my hope would be that everyone here in America, we're all searching for the authentic America. And so many of us feel that it's been lost a little bit in the dissonance of an overstimulated society. And so much of our energies are being misdirected in ways that it's hard to articulate. So it's my hope that light and liberty, the philosophy and the wisdom of Thomas Jefferson, will find its way into our educational system, particularly schools, high schools, colleges, as well as into public discourse.
Yeah.
We sent the book when it was first published by Random House a few years ago to every member of Congress. We sent it to every member of the Supreme Court. And I got back some wonderful letters saying, yes, this is the spirit, this is the true, authentic American spirit, voiced so purely and so eloquently in the writings of Thomas Jefferson.
Exactly. Is there, these days, as we both know, in our 21st century world, even with a book, and perhaps especially with a book, there is often an associated website or some place where people can obtain information about book author, purpose, and such. Is there?
Yes, thank you very much, George. Yes, the name of the website is the title of the book, Light and Liberty.org. No Spaces Between Light and Liberty. We've had some wonderful commentary on the book. You mentioned the one from Archbishop Tutu. We had another nice one from President Mikhail Gorbachev, again indicating the international appeal of, mm-hmm. of Thomas Jefferson. He said that the lessons of Thomas Jefferson can be very valuable to us today,
right,
as we are learning to strengthen relations with one another and live together in harmony.
Right. We only have time for a very brief comment, Eric, as we conclude, but I can't resist asking you this, because so much of this book, like Jefferson's own life, is concerned with governance, how we govern our society. And for me, it linked the qualities we should have as individuals with the kind of honesty, which he emphasizes, that we should see reflected in our government. It also occurred to me, Eric, that Jefferson, like his colleagues of that era, was a man deeply grounded in literature, philosophy, and just sort of had this sense of history behind everything he wrote, which may not be the case with today's politicians. You mentioned the reception you were getting from politicians about this book. Can you foresee or hope for through this kind of inspiration, a return of that kind of spirit, of the political leader as a well-rounded American figure, rooted in our history, rooted in world culture, just obeying philosophical principles as much as anything else in what he or she does?
I think so. I believe that that's intrinsic to the character of our nation, that individuals will come forth from time to time when they're necessary and lead in the spirit that our founders had in mind. Thomas Jefferson believed that there are only two legitimate objects to government, the equal rights of man and the happiness of every individual. He knew that we'd have difficult times. He said, "We too shall encounter follies, but if great, they will be short. If long, they will be light, and the vigor of our people will get the better of them." So he was a great American optimist.
Yeah.
He knew that we'd come through difficult times.
Eric Peterson, I thank you very much for the pleasure of your company, for this conversation, and for this book.
It's been a real treat, George. I thank you for doing this interview, and I appreciate your kind words about Light and Liberty.
Well, I hope everyone reads it. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Eric S. Peterson. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler, and our associate producer is Sharana Ward. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
To order a Dialogue program or for more information, contact us at 202-691-4146. You can also listen to Dialogue on the web at wilsoncenter.org/dialogue. Email us at dialogue@wwic.si.edu. That's dialogue@wwic.si.edu.